layer up in long-sleeve running shirts. I also grab two hats and throw them on. It's a universally accepted fact that you lose a lot of warmth through your head. If you keep your head warm in the severe cold, you'll have won half the battle of keeping your body warm. I usually always prefer to run in shorts, regardless of the temperature, but tonight I choose to put on a thin thermal legging because it's so damn cold. During the ride down the 37 flights on the elevator, Steele doesn't even look at me. It's like he's infuriated with me. Actually, he looks like he's mad at something way bigger than just me. Is he mad at the world? "Let's get the fuck out of here," he says as the elevator opens. "Fuck it, let's do six," Steele says as we leave. I don't even question it because he looks so mad. We run 6 miles in Central Park. Usually, I run the loop of Central Park in a clockwise direction, but tonight, he wants to run it in the opposite direction. He tells me we hit way more hills going this way. Not sure I really get that. To me, it sounds like a word problem I had in eighth grade math, but there's no time to discuss. Off we go. Steele does not look at his watch once during the run, and when we finish, he hits the stop button on his GPS. I hear a beep indicating the run is done and logged. "We did those in nines," he says. He then looks down at his watch, exactly 54 minutes. It's like he's a human GPS. "Steele, how the fuck did you know we were running nines without checking your watch?" "Instincts. You need to feel the pace. This guy's like the Obi-Wan Kenobi of running." 20 minutes later. It's about 10 p.m. and I'm starting to think about sleep. I'm usually not hungry after I work out, and tonight's no different. I guzzle a glass of water and wash up. Sarah's reading People magazine in the living room. 10 minutes later. I walk to Steele's room to say goodnight and see if he needs anything. Our relationship is still in the infancy stages, and I want to make sure he feels welcome. I lightly knock on his door 3 times and then peek my head in. He's sitting upright in his bed like he knew I was going to come in. "Hey, man," I say, "you cool?" "You know what, Jesse?" Steele says. "No, I'm not cool. I'm sick of this shit." Steele pounds his fist on the bed. "You're too pretty, man. Too cute. Fuck you." "What?" "Go grab a chair. The most uncomfortable chair you can find." I have no idea what he's talking about, but I go and get a wooden chair with no armrests out of my home office and return to his room. "This?" "That's perfect," Steele says. "Sit down." I sit in the chair. "Now go grab a fucking blanket," he says. "Wait, what?" He really doesn't think I'm going to sleep in a chair. "You got to get out of your comfort zone, Jesse," he says. "Enough of this comfy shit. Fuck this Park Avenue bullshit." He repeats himself under his breath. "Fucking Park Avenue bullshit." But we live on Central Park West. So I grab a blanket and try to get comfortable sitting in a chair. Every time I try to stretch out to get into a more of a reclined bed position, I slide down off the chair. Then Sarah walks in. "Hey, honey, what are you doing?" "Sweetie, Steele says I need to get out of my comfort zone. He wants me to sleep in this chair. It must be a mental thing." I'm trying to spin this as positively as I can. It's almost like I'm trying to convince myself that this is a good idea. "Jess, you're a 42-year-old father. Please go and get into your bed." My wife knows what I signed up for, but she slightly rolls her eyes, a judgmental expression that's somewhat neutralized by her smile. Sarah also knows I'm going to make every attempt to complete any and all of Steele's challenges, but she didn't think I'd be told to sleep in a chair. The blanket isn't helping, and the chair squeaks every time I shift positions. My wife shakes her head, turns, and walks back to the bedroom to our comfy, bazillion thread count sheet bed. My wife likes nice sheets. It's midnight. Lights out. Workout totals: 14.3 miles, 8.3 miles in the morning, and 6 miles at night. Sarah's first sighting. I don't do shit for applauses. I don't do shit for fanfare. I do shit for me. Steele. The first time Sarah saw Steele was before he moved in with us, but after I flew to the West Coast to offer my invitation. I told my wife I wanted to run the Badwater Race. It's a grueling 135-mile ultramarathon through the Mojave Desert's Death Valley in 130-degree heat and that's in the shade. Sarah thought that was the dumbest thing she ever heard and insisted I first go watch the race to see what it was all about before I entered it myself. And like a good husband, I agreed. And because of the extreme nature of the race and inherent danger, she decided that she ought to come too, you know, for a second opinion. I'd always wanted to complete the Badwater race. It's considered the toughest foot race on earth, and rightfully so. 135 miles, 130 degree heat, plus the last 13 miles of the race are a straight ascent up Mount Whitney. I also knew Seal was running it. I just felt like this was the race to do for my life resume. It was the ultimate physical and mental challenge, and I wanted to take the test. I guess I also wanted to be able to look at other runners in the face and say, I completed Badwater. Like I said earlier, I want to get better. So that summer, for our family vacation, we flew across the country in July to watch the race. Since there are no direct flights, or any flights for that matter, into Death Valley, we had to fly into Las Vegas, rent a car, and drive a few hours to the desert. The ride to Death Valley is long and boring, straight through the desert. Not a great way to spend your vacation if you're Sarah, but I was psyched to watch the race. We got there just after the final wave of runners started the race. We drove out about 20 miles past the start to cheer on the competitors. Any description I could offer here wouldn't do justice to just how hot it was. As we arrived, the thermometer in the car showed the outside temp to be 128 degrees. It was so hot that at first Sarah wouldn't even get out of the car. We parked at the 30-mile mark and watched the racers pass with the air conditioner inside blasting. Now, I'm not sure if you've ever seen an ultramarathon before, but the competitors are an interesting breed of humans. As Sarah said, it's like they put 90 people from an insane asylum onto a Greyhound bus, drove them out to the desert, blew a whistle, and said, run for 2 days. She wasn't far off. Most of the runners looked like a cross between scrawny science teachers and confused goat herders. As we cheered on the runners, they enjoyed our support by thanking us and giving us high fives. Some even engaged in light conversation. Sarah could not believe the group. She anticipated super fit athletes, not folks who looked like mad scientists in running shorts. But then, over the horizon, she saw what she thought was a mirage coming towards us. It was like the music from Chariots of Fire started playing in Death Valley as he approached. The guy was a machine. He stared straight ahead like there was nothing in his path and ran. His muscles were like a locomotive train. As he passed us, Sarah jumped up and down and yelled, go, go, go. Although there wasn't another human within a mile of us or him, he didn't even react. No thank you, no smile, no anything. Holy shit, she exclaimed. What the hell was that? Several months later, that moved into our house. Day 4, fitness test. I don't think about yesterday. I think about today and getting better. Seal. New York City, 25 degrees, 0530. I've been in and out of sleep all night, but officially wake up in the chair at 5:30 a.m. I've never been more happy to be up at 5:30 a.m. in my life. My neck is killing me. I have an L-shaped back and my knees are locked. I think I got 2 hours of sleep max. Seal meets me in the den at 5:45. He looks like he's already showered, had coffee, and read the morning paper. Maybe he has. He doesn't say a word about the chair. Nothing. Now that we are 3 days into his stay and have built the foundation, Seal decides he wants to test where I'm at physically. We agreed last night to an 0600 start time for our fit test. Agreed means he told me when we're waking up. Before Seal got here, I had no idea how to convert military time into regular human time, the time the rest of the world operates on. But now I'm completely fluent in the conversion. So at 5:45, we head down to the gym for our test. Before we get started, Seal takes his shirt off. He looks at himself in the gym mirror. It's almost like he's doing it in slow motion, checking to see if he added more definition to his Hulk-like body overnight. I apologize and explain that he has to keep his clothing on in the building gym, that those are the rules, that other residents will be coming down soon. He acts like I'm taking a toy away from him and telling him to brush his teeth, like it's my rule, like I'm the stuffy one. "That's the dumbest shit ever," he says. "This is a gym. Gyms have mirrors." I know, but that's the rules. Well, whoever made that rule's an asshole. He reluctantly keeps his shirt on, and we walk over to the pull-up bar for what he's coined nickels and dimes. We do 5 pull-ups, nickels, and then 10 push-ups, dimes, every minute on the minute. We start every time the second hand's on the 12. If we finish in 40 seconds, we then have 20 seconds of rest. We do this for 10 minutes, 50 pull-ups and 100 push-ups. However, by the time we get to 4 minutes, I have to drop my pull-up count to 3. I can't keep up. I'm a runner, but this is a totally different skill set. I assume most 43-year-old men aren't doing 8 pull-ups, let alone 50. Seal doesn't say anything. He just pulls out his tiny journal and scribbles in it. I'm already incredibly sore and struggling. Pull-ups are not my thing. Plus, I'm still sore from the pull-ups 3 days ago. Seal says, "Okay, now we get started." What? We head over to the treadmill. Seal hands me 2 20-pound dumbbells and sets the controls. Incline, 8. Speed, 4.0. He pushes the start button. I do this for 8 minutes. It's like a brisk walk up or a moderate-sized hill carrying a couple of suitcases. Then, every minute thereafter, Seal increases the incline by 1. By incline 10, it feels like I'm walking up a steep hill carrying 2 camp trucks. By 15, I'm climbing the side of a mountain holding 2 minivans. When I'm done, my shoulder blades feel like they're on fire. My thighs are jacked up. My lungs are so expanded, it feels like they're gonna burst my rib cage. Seal pulls out his tiny journal and marks it as such. In fact, I tell him to jot it down in bold. Miserable. We head over to the box jump. It's 24 inches high. He times me how long it takes me to do 50. 1 minute, 57 seconds. Seal pulls out his tiny journal and marks it as such. Then we go outside and run 6 miles. It takes me an hour. I'm miserable. Miserable. Seal pulls out his tiny journal and marks it as such. What's amazing is that Seal not only does every single workout with me, but he also does his own personal workouts on top of this. It's like the workouts we're doing that are knocking me out are not nearly enough for him. My workouts are like his jumping jacks for a warm-up. We've only been together for a few days, and I never really see Seal lifting weights, but the guy is always doing push-ups. It's like push-ups are his hobby, or more like it's his job. Or better yet, it's his hobby and his job. Anytime I go into the kitchen, I see him doing push-ups in his room or in the hallway. He'll be in position, pushing up and down, and completely out of nowhere, the guy will drop and give himself 20. At work, in the lobby, in the restroom, anywhere and everywhere. It's not normal. Today, for example, when the doorman came to the apartment to drop off some packages that were delivered, Seal answered the door and welcomed him in. As the doorman was placing the packages by the wall, he tried to engage Seal in conversation. "You good?" the doorman asked. Rather than answer and continue a normal conversation, Seal drops to the floor and starts doing rapid-fire push-ups. "Hey, man, just leave that shit by the wall. Appreciate it," he says, and goes up and down and up and down and up and down. Workout totals: 6 miles, 15-minute treadmill test, 50 box jumps, 36 pull-ups, and 100 push-ups. Day 5. Escape vehicle. It doesn't have to be fun. It has to be effective. Seal. New York City, 20 degrees, 0800. I'm on the couch reading the New York Post. The door to the apartment opens. It's Seal. He's back from doing an errand. This is fucking amazing. Seal is holding a 50-pound camouflage backpack and 4 oars. What's that for? I set down the paper and sit up a little straighter on the couch. It's your escape vehicle out of Manhattan, he says. In this backpack is an inflatable raft that carries a maximum load of 450 pounds. Pull this cord and it inflates instantly. He shows me the cord. You, Sarah, and Laser can all fit in it comfortably and paddle to Jersey. Brilliant, I say. Man, this shit is so badass, he says. It's low to the water and impossible to see at night. It has an attachable motor. If you time your escape right, you can get out of Dodge undetected. Poof. This is the most animated I've seen Seal since he got here. But why would we want to escape, I ask? In case some 9/11 shit happens again. There's only one way out, the river. The city shuts down all bridges and tunnels and access points. How the fuck else do you plan to get out? What's the plan? Plan? I don't have a plan. Well, you do now. You're gonna row, row, row your boat the fuck out of here. Makes sense to me. As Seal and I are admiring the 50-pound backpack and the four oars, Sarah walks in the front door. My wife looks down at the backpack and then up at us. She's a bit confused. Sweetie, Seal got us a backpack that turns into an inflatable raft in case we ever need to get out of the city, I say. An inflatable raft? We live on the 37th floor in an apartment in Manhattan. Yeah, Seal said the bridges and tunnels get shut down during an emergency. It's protocol. A raft is the only way out. We just bring it to the Hudson River and inflate it. Then we paddle to New Jersey. Okay, love. She sets the mail down on the kitchen counter. That's it? Just okay, love? Any thoughts? Well, just so I understand, I'm supposed to grab my son, strap a 50-pound backpack on my shoulders, carry four oars, walk a mile to the river, inflate this survival raft, and then paddle to New Jersey in the middle of a national emergency? There's dead silence in the room. Then more dead silence. Sarah chimes in and says, I'm not even sure I could lift this thing. Nah, you'll be fine, Seal says as he grabs the backpack and puts it on Sarah's back. She falls straight over backward. I think to myself, she has a point. Finally, Seal interjects. I can tell he's about to lose it and he's been holding in his words, but now he can't hold them in any longer. Sarah, don't ever underestimate the power of adrenaline, he says. So we put the backpack behind the bar. 4 hours later. Come on, we're going to do the 100 workout. Seal explains the routine and I realize that he needs help with his math. It's really the 500 workout. We jump on the elevator and head down to the gym. There are already three people working out when we get there. While the gym is fully operational and is loaded with equipment, it's rare that more than a handful of residents are ever there working out at the same time. There's a guy with blonde hair doing what looks like a serious core workout. Seal looks at the guy and then back at me. What the fuck is Billy Idol doing here? Seal asks. That's Sting, I whisper. He lives in the building. We do 100 dumbbell bench presses 2 times, no rest. And I start with 30-pound weights but end with 20-pounders. Total, 200. 100 lateral pull-downs 2 times, 75 pounds. Total, 200. 100 shoulder presses seated. Total, 100. Like I said, that's 500, not 100. Extra credit? 2 times light tricep pull-downs and 2 times curls. It's time to leave. We make our way out of the gym. Well, that didn't look fun, Sting says. 7 p.m. It's Saturday night and most of the people I know are watching college football. Not us, because apparently Seal does have a friend, someone he met in the gym yesterday. They must have become close because the guy lets Seal borrow his 50-pound weight vest. Seal hands it to me. Put it on. I grab it and put one arm in at a time. I throw the vest over my shoulders and strap it on. My immediate reaction is, this is heavy. Like, really heavy. It's like having a big suitcase on your back. We do 15 sets of 10 push-ups with 30 seconds of rest between sets. Total, 150. It takes me 22 minutes. It takes Seal 15 minutes. This is no punk, Seal says, and it's not. It's so hard that even Seal can't go straight to 10 without dropping to his knees after his 6th set. Yet all he keeps saying is, this is great. This is not great. This is brutally hard. I found out Seal once entered a race where you could either run for 24 or 48 hours. Shocker. Seal signed up for the 48-hour one. At around the 23-hour mark, he'd run approximately 130 miles, but he'd also torn his quad. He asked the race officials if they could just clock him out at 24 hours. When he was told they couldn't do that, he said, "Roger that," asked for a roll of tape, and wrapped his quad. He walked, limped, on a torn quad for the last 24 hours to finish the race and completed the entire 48 hours. When you think you're done, you're only at 40% of what your body is capable of doing. That's just the limit that we put on ourselves. Workout totals. 500 workout, bench presses, lat pull-downs, shoulder presses, and 150 push-ups. Señoras de la limpieza. I don't need new friends. I like to keep my shit lean and tight. Seal. We have two cleaning ladies who come to the apartment twice a week. They don't speak a lick of English, and I don't speak a lick of Spanish. So I have to use props and diagrams to communicate. If I want them to vacuum, I go get a magazine and show them a picture of a vacuum. If I want them to clean the windows, I show them a photo of Windex and point to the glass. I keep a stash of Us Weekly around just for communication purposes. I'm always pointing to stuff and showing them a picture of what I need them to do. It's kind of like a combination of American Sign Language and charades. It can get challenging. But when Seal came into the world, there was no way I could explain it to them. I mean, what do I do? Show them a picture of Russell Crowe and Gladiator? Or Stallone and Rambo? But as I've come to learn, some things don't need to be communicated. These women were immediately obsessed with him. I mean, Seal's a nice-looking man, have I mentioned that? And he walks around without a shirt a lot. A lot. In fact, I'm starting to notice that Sarah's friends are coming over lately for no reason. I guess they want to just look at Seal. Since he's moved in, the cleaning gals seem to be spending an extra hour or two cleaning. They also seem to be spending a lot of time in his room, despite the fact the guy's spotless. His room doesn't need cleaning, ever. Military corners. You could bounce a quarter off the bed after he makes it. All his gear is stowed. I mean, the bedroom looks like it's right out of a boot camp. But the ladies are always in there when Seal's around, talking to each other in Spanish and giggling. In the other direction, Seal doesn't even acknowledge them. He's not exactly rude to them. It's more like a silent assessment, and he doesn't trust them. Yesterday, he ordered something that was FedExed to the apartment, and one of the cleaning ladies accepted the package. He freaked out. Not to them, but to me. "It's a breach of security," he said. Breach of security? The integrity of the delivery was compromised. He went on to lecture me about my naivete when it comes to insubordination of the people who work for me. The only thing he ever said about anyone was that they should be fired. Seal didn't think anyone who worked for the Itzlers cared enough or did their job like they should. He was really mad or suspicious of everyone he came into contact with except for Sarah, Laser, and me. According to Seal, if my driver, Smith, was a minute late, it was because he didn't study the routes correctly. If there was traffic, Smith should have anticipated the accident. And looking back on it now, I'm not sure Seal was wrong. He was taught that if you have a job to do, you do it with 120% effort. I've been operating under the assumption that if someone that works for me does something 80% of the way I would do it, that's enough. Seal is teaching me that we can all do so much more. Day 6. That damn finger. It's really not that complicated, Seal. New York City, 29 degrees, 0400. It's 4 a.m. I hear some banging and mumbling in the living room. Banging, mumbling, and banging, mumbling. Although I'm half asleep, I decide to check it out. When I get to the living room, Seal is on the couch holding the remote control. Well, holding is really not an appropriate description. He's slamming the remote control against the armrest of the couch as if that may turn the TV on. "This motherfucker," he mumbles, "is too complicated. Too many buttons. It's making me fucking nuts." Seal looks like he may implode. His eyebrows are arched, and he looks like he could attack anything. Right now, he's attacking the remote, but since I'm the closest human, I'm alarmed. So, I immediately grab the remote and hit power, then switch the command to cable 1. I put on ESPN and hand Seal the remote. "Just use the channel and volume controls for now. No need to even shut it off. I'll shut off the TV in the morning." Seal's eyebrows contort back to normal as he watches some football highlights. I go back to bed. 0600. I hear my bedroom door slowly open. There's no nice way to put this, but it's a bit unnerving because my wife is in bed next to me, and I can sense someone else in the room with us. I feel a tap. I half open my eyes and imagine I see a long black finger on my shoulder. I roll over. My wife is sound asleep. Plus, the finger I'm imagining doesn't look anything like her finger. I ignore the finger. I must be dreaming. 10 seconds later, I feel another tap on my shoulder. I'm hoping it's my wife, but this finger does not belong to her. The finger keeps tapping me. In the other hand is a remote. I ignore it again. 20 seconds later, I feel hot breath whispering into my ear in a monotone voice. I guess the loud, intentional noise in the hallway trick wasn't working for him. Get up, motherfucker, Seal says. I get up, fast. Sarah remains motionless and oblivious next to me. Seal tells me we'll run another 6 miles in Central Park this AM. That this is our last primer, then we start. Start? I thought we started days ago. I go into the living room and shut the TV off. Central Park's where most of our training occurs. Park Drive is a 6.1-mile loop in the heart of Manhattan. Back in the 1970s, before they routed the race through the five boroughs, the New York City Marathon was held in Central Park. The marathoners ran around the loop 4 times plus. I've run the course hundreds of times since I moved to Manhattan, as it serves as a perfect training ground with its rolling hills, few cars at this time of the morning, which probably disappoints Seal, and other runners and bikers to interact with. It's chilly today with the wind, but only until we start running. Our breath comes out in puffs of white. That's all that comes out of Seal. He doesn't make a sound. He runs like a submarine, silent, deadly. The thought reminds me of a fart joke I heard in 5th grade. We do the first 3 miles at a 10-minute per mile pace, then the next 2 at an 8-minute pace. And the final mile is 7 minutes. When we get home, my son is still asleep. So is my wife. She doesn't even know there was a finger tapping me in bed earlier. The past 2 days, when we came home from our morning runs, I've been drenched in sweat, soaked. My routine's been simple. I shower, grab a bowl of fruit, grab some bananas, then go to work. I only eat fruit until noon. That's been my thing since I read Fit for Life by Harvey Diamond in 1992. For over 25 years, just fruit till noon. Harvey's another one of the interesting people that I cold called to be my friend. His story's fascinating. Harvey was exposed to Agent Orange, perhaps the most toxic molecule ever synthesized by man, during the Vietnam War. Agent Orange has been linked to various cancers, lymphomas, and multiple chronic diseases. As far as I know, Harvey's the only American soldier who was exposed to the deadly chemical and is still alive. He credits it to a philosophy and lifestyle called natural hygiene, and he lays out the roadmap in Fit for Life. I read the book 3 times, and it completely changed my life. So one day, I decided to call Harvey and introduce myself, no different than Seal. I tracked down his number, picked up the phone, and got him on the line. He checked the yes box to being my friend, and we've been great friends since. He's another character in my life that my wife tolerates. Every time we talk, he ends the call with, "Fruit till noon, brother." One of the main underlying philosophies in his book is that we use more energy for digestion than all other bodily functions combined. That's why we're usually tired after a big meal. That said, the average American will eat 70 tons of food in their lifetime. Imagine how hard the body has to work to process and break down all that food. The more efficiently we can digest all this food and the less stress we put on the digestive process, the more energy we will have for everything else. According to Fit for Life, fruit is the perfect food because on top of being sweet and delicious, it's super easy to digest. In fact, it's the only food that bypasses the stomach and is digested in the small intestines. It unleashes all its nutrients and goodness without using much, if any, energy, which frees up your energy for other things. As long as you eat fruit on an empty stomach, you can reap amazing benefits. According to Diamond, you don't have to look beyond the animal kingdom to see evidence of this. The strongest animals in the world thrive on a fruit and plant-based diet. Silverback gorillas, for example, are 30 times as strong as man and 3 times our size. Their DNA is 99% similar to that of humans, and they are our closest living relatives next to chimps. How are they so strong? Oh yeah, their diet is made up mostly of fruits and leaves. The silverback gorilla doesn't eat turkey sandwiches, chips, and McDonald's. Makes sense to me. After reading the book in 1992, I decided to try the concept out for myself. I religiously stuck to a fruit-only diet until noon every day for 10 days. Afternoon, I generally kept it pretty clean. No fried foods, no dairy, no meats, but I didn't waver from the fruit only in the AM. I had an enormous amount of energy during that span and very efficient digestion. I felt so good that the 10-day trial period turned into 20-plus years of following this routine. It doesn't matter if I'm running a marathon in the morning, I still stick to this program, Fruit Till Noon. 1 p.m. 45 minutes after I get to the office this morning, Seal arrives. I'm back sitting in front of my computer when he gets there. I ordered in a salmon platter and some veggie dumplings from Josie's. I ate them like a wrestler right after his weigh-in. It's been about an hour since I had lunch. Zico's marketing team has presented some new packaging, and we're reviewing the options. Seal sits in a chair in my office, motionless. That is, until he jumps out of the chair unprompted. "Burpee test, motherfucker," he barks. I'm sorry, what? "Burpee test, motherfucker. Why do I have to keep repeating myself?" "I just didn't know what you meant." "Dude, you know what a fucking burpee is, right?" He's not really asking, but telling me. "Yeah, I know what a burpee is. And you know what a motherfucking test is, right?" "Yes, I know what a test is." "Well then, motherfucker, this is a burpee test." Seal tells me he wants to time how long it takes me to do 100 burpees. "It's a fitness test," he says, "and make sure to emphasize these are burpees with push-ups." He explains that anything under 10 minutes is solid. Under 11 minutes is acceptable. And he finds over 13 minutes is unacceptable. "In fact, if you don't go under 13 minutes, we're doing them again," he says. Well, I'm not really good at burpees, and I find doing one set of 15 to be a friggin' pain. Seal takes off his watch and presses the start button. Beep! "Wait, I have to change into something. Clock's already started, bitch." I immediately drop to the floor in a plank position, do a push-up, kick my knees to my chest, and jump up into a jumping jack. 1. I get to 10 in 55 seconds. I'm on pace. Problem is, I'm already starting to sweat, and I'm in my work clothes. I'm in my work clothes because I'm at work. Plus, I need to look presentable for my meetings today. I don't want to get them all sweaty. So I use, or waste, however you want to look at it, the next 10 precious seconds taking my shirt off and then my shoes and socks. And finally my pants. I'm now in my boxers in my office. 11, 12, 13, I keep going. The clock is ticking. And I'm at 50 at 5 minutes and 30 seconds. I'm slowing down, but I'm still on pace for acceptable. I can feel sweat on my face and rolling down the center of my back. The door opens. But I only see the back of her head before the blonde hair quickly exits. It's Jennifer Kish, my right-hand person at the office. She's gone before I can explain. I want to yell, "Burpee test, motherfucker!" But the door's already closed behind her. I wonder what she's thinking. I keep going. When I get to 60, I start breaking down the remaining 40 burpees into sets of 10. 10 burpees and then a 10 to 15 second rest. 11 minutes, 45 seconds. Done. I grab an old t-shirt I happen to have laying around and I wipe myself off. I'm soaked. And my thighs feel like they're broken. I throw the soaking wet t-shirt into the garbage can by my desk and put my work clothes on. Soon enough, I'm back at my computer looking at the color options on the packaging. My legs tremble and shake under my desk. Work resumes and a slight smile comes over my face as I think, "Burpee test, bitch." I work for 9 hours straight. 2200. I walk home from work at 10 p.m. with Seal. It's been a long day. We've been working on Zico all day with the design people, and I'm wiped out. While we were able to be additive with the new packaging, a big part of our role is generating sizzle for the brand. Every day we ask ourselves, how do we generate buzz and excitement around our products? But generating the buzz today took a lot out of me. I just want to turn on the television, maybe watch the fourth quarter of the Knicks game and veg out. I lie down on the couch and look for the remote. Seal's been with me all day at the office, and he's seen how intense it's been. The only real time I was alone today was when I went to the bathroom. It might have been the best 5 minutes of my day. I'm beat, so I'm not going to say anything about working out if he doesn't. Plus, we've already run 6 miles and done 100 burpees. I grab the remote and flip on the television. Seal doesn't watch much TV. I feel like he just watches me watch TV. It's very uncomfortable, and it makes me not want to even watch TV. You a Knicks fan, he asks. All my life, I say. You ever go to the games? I do, I say. I've had season tickets for years. I even wrote their theme song back in the day. A song? Rap song, theme song, sort of like an anthem, I say. Then sing a little, go New York, go New York, go. You ever hear of it? That's it? That's what? That's the whole song? No, that's only the chorus. There's a whole verse and then you repeat the chorus, you know? Doesn't seem that complicated. I'm not sure if it's complicated or if it's simple, but I do know that it worked, I respond. I was a 23-year-old recording artist signed to a small independent record label called Delicious Vinyl when I wrote Go New York Go in 1993. I somehow convinced the Knicks brass they needed a new theme song and that we could get Spike Lee and other celebs in a video around the song if we did it correctly. They gave me a shot. Go New York Go became the Knicks anthem and the number one most requested song on New York radio during the 1993-1994 NBA playoffs. The lyrics were licensed by Budweiser, Foot Locker, and other major brands. I felt like I had finally arrived. I was big time. Well, not really big time. The Knicks paid me $4,000 to write the song. After I paid the studio, engineer, producer, and musicians, I think I netted about $300, and a net worth of $300 isn't really big time. But to me it was. Any success I ever had in my life usually occurred when I was not chasing the money, but was doing things out of passion. And as far as music, I was never in it for the money. But it's not like I just woke up one day and said I want to write and record a hip-hop theme song for the New York Knicks. It started much earlier than that. After graduation from American University, my plan A was to get a record deal and to be on MTV. That's it. There was no plan B. There was no financial goal. I just wanted to be on MTV. Getting a record deal is one of the hardest things you can ever do. The odds of even getting a meeting with the right person are very low, and the odds of getting signed? Those are virtually astronomical. If you don't have a powerful lawyer or know someone, then the astronomical odds become ridiculously astronomical. I didn't have either. In 1988, a show on MTV called Yo MTV Raps debuted. The program was like the Jackie Robinson of rap TV. It broke all sorts of barriers and injected rap into mainstream culture. Still, by 1990, you could count the number of white hip-hop artists who were receiving any kind of acceptance in the larger community on one of Ice Cube's hands. The Beastie Boys were at the top of the list, along with Third Base. Maybe it was naivete or pure determination, probably both, but despite the enormous odds facing me, I knew what I was going to do. I was going to be on Yo MTV Raps. A few weeks after Pomp and Circumstance played at my graduation ceremony, I got a phone call from a fraternity brother who had moved to L.A. to be a production assistant on a movie called The Bonfire of the Vanities. As he got settled in California, he invited me out to L.A. to check out the movie set and the girls. I'd never been to Cali, so I hopped on a plane and headed west. At the time, there was a hot new independent label called Delicious Vinyl located off Sunset Boulevard. Delicious was an ultra-hip recording outfit with two of the hottest artists on pop radio, Tone Loc and Young MC. Loc's song Wild Thing was the number one selling single in the country, and Young's Bust a Move was blowing up the charts. If I could write my own script, this would be the perfect label for me. Fun, irreverent, successful, different. I had to meet the owners. The guy who was the head of Delicious Vinyl was named Mike Ross. In the music business, creating and distributing a song usually works like this. There's the artist who's signed by a label. Once that deal's done, either the artist has a particular producer they always work with to create and record the songs. Michael Jackson, for example, was always produced by Quincy Jones. Or the label hires a producer to work with the artist. That is, of course, unless the artist does it all himself. Mike Ross was one of the rare label owners who also produced the music his label released. Along with his partner Matt Dyke, Ross was one of the most dynamic rap producers in the business. I had read that Mike was a big fan of a Brooklyn-born rapper named Dana Dane. A big fan. As it turned out, Dana Dane recorded at Herbie Lovebug Azor's studio, the same studio I recorded at. And one night while I was at the studio, I saw an advanced copy of Dana's album lying on the mix board. I decided to borrow it while nobody was looking. Couldn't hurt. It was his second album and highly anticipated in the music community. I brought the cassette with me to L.A. Nobody outside of Dana's inner clique had even heard it yet. After only 2 days in L.A., I decided to cold call Mike Ross at Delicious Vinyl. Why not, I thought. If I was going to take a shot, I might as well take one from outside the arc. I literally got his office number out of the phone book and called the main line. I didn't have a game plan other than try to get a meeting with Mike. Delicious Vinyl, may I help you? The receptionist said. Mike Ross, please. Sure, please hold. 45 seconds later. This is Dina, Mike Ross's assistant. Can I help you? Mike, please. Mike's not in. Who's calling? Jesse. Jesse who? Jesse. I'm a friend of Dana Dane's. Dana wanted me to drop off his new cassette for Mike while I'm in town. I'm leaving tomorrow. He said it's urgent. Mike knows about it. Please hold. I covered the receiver with my hand and whispered to my friend John, I'm on hold. Maybe it was my thick Long Island accent disconnecting with her Cali vibe, or maybe it was the universe wanting me to get in the door, but 30 seconds later, she comes back. So you're Dana Dane? Obviously, I don't look like Dana. He's African-American and I'm white. He has a gold front tooth and I don't, etc. I guess I could have cleared up the misunderstanding right then and there, but when your foot is half in the door, you don't pull it out. So without pausing, I say, yes, I'm Dana. Okay, hold on. 1 minute later. Dana, Mike's excited to meet you. Can you come in today around 2 p.m.? Yes, ma'am. I'll be there. Game on, motherfucker. At precisely 2 o'clock, I show up at the Delicious Vinyl offices. I'm 21 years old. I walk up the stairs to the second floor, where the buzzer to announce yourself is located. I push the button for entry. A very sexy receptionist voice chimes in through the speaker box. Who is it? Oh, it's Dana Dane, here to see Mike Ross, please, I respond. 10 seconds later, buzz, I'm in. Mike Ross's assistant leads me to his office and sits me down right on the chair across from Mike's big-ass executive desk. Mike will be back in 5 minutes, Dana, she tells me, right before she offers me some water. She closes the door behind her, and there I am, just me, sitting in Mike's big, cool, unlit office. There are gold records hanging on the walls, different album covers, photos, really cool graffiti. A patchouli candle is burning on his desk. The office is amazing. I start to read the credits on Tone Loc's platinum album hanging on the wall and check out some of the awards on Mike's desk. Then the door opens. And Mike Ross appears. He's baffled. Who are you? He said. What's up, Mike? I'm Jesse. I work with Dana. He's running a little late. Late? Yeah, he's maybe like 20 minutes behind. How do you know Dana? I never met Dana. I record with him at the same studio. My producer's part of his production crew called Idolmakers, and I did a few songs for him too. You sing? No, I actually rap. You rap? With Dana? I figured I would continue to confuse him as it has worked thus far. Yeah, well, not with him directly, but I'm part of a group signed to Virgin. But Dana thinks I should do a solo thing. Virgin? Do you have any songs with you? Yeah, I do. Can I pop this cassette in while we wait? Sure. I handed Mike a copy of my 3-song demo, and College Girls comes on first. Anywhere I go, a fly girl will please me. East to west, college girls are easy. He listens for 30 seconds and stops the tape. This is fucking amazing. Man, thanks, brother. I think it's a hit. Who's your lawyer? Excuse me? Who's your lawyer? He asks again. And just like that, after 2 years of getting doors slammed in my face, he hit me with the four magic words every artist shopping a demo wants to hear. Who is your lawyer? In fact, he asked me twice. Since I didn't have a lawyer and I didn't even know any lawyers, I told him, oh, my dad is. Your dad's an entertainment lawyer? At the time, my dad owned a plumbing supply company, but it was the first answer that popped in my head. I'm a get your foot in the door, figure it out later guy. So I responded with a firm yes. Yep, my dad does all my stuff. I'm going to have my attorney contact your dad. I want to buy this song for Loke. That's incredible. If Loke did this song... Then I paused. Loke? I realized that this song was my ticket to a deal. Sure, I could have sold it to Tone Loke. Wild Thing had sold over 3 million units at the time, but this was the lead song on my demo. So I responded, actually, I really think this song is a big hit. I gotta keep this one for me. It's going on my album. That makes sense. Well, would you be willing to write for Loke then? And that was the official start of my music career. Mike gave me the instrumentals for four songs he wanted me to write for Tone Loke and sent me back to my friend's apartment. 2 hours later, I called him on his Nokia with lyrics for all of the songs. He was at a Dodgers game and could barely hear me over the din of the stadium, but he heard enough to meet me back at his office when the game was over. There, I not only signed a deal to write songs for Tone Loke, but he signed me on the spot for my own album. Dana later became a great friend and we still laugh about it. Thanks, Dana. Maybe the best part of my music career was the fact that I didn't sell that many records. As my wife likes to say, failure is just life's way of nudging you and letting you know you're off course. Yes, I was on MTV and got to tour the country, but the hockey stick curve sales trajectory wasn't there. So I decided to call an audible and look for other opportunities in music. Writing theme songs for sports teams seemed like a great niche. I love music, love sports, and nobody else was doing it. The result was Go New York Go. I started a niche, sports music. There must be an echo in here because I keep hearing Seal say, doesn't seem that complicated. Seal's a lot of things, but he's not a music critic. Rather than debate this, out of my mouth comes, you're right, it's really not that complicated. Pretty simple, actually. Yeah, it's simple, he says. I start flipping the channels. I don't even find the Knicks game on the tube before Seal suggests we take the conversation outside and get in another workout. It's 10:45 p.m. The upside is this is the first time he's actually asking questions about me. Not that I want him to, but it makes it easier to get to know someone when there's a back and forth. As my wife likes to remind me, when I talk to you, please play tennis with me and hit the ball back. It's called communication, and it's important to a marriage. And although I'm not looking to get married to Seal, my wife has a valid point. Our workout is basically the same routine as the morning, a loop around Central Park, except tonight comes with a bonus. Every half mile, we do 25 push-ups. The other difference is that Seal wants the pace to escalate, meaning every mile has to be slightly faster than the previous mile. We start out at a 9 minute per mile pace, and at 4 minutes and 30 seconds into the run, we drop and do 25 push-ups. Then we increase to an 8 minute and 50 second per mile pace, and 4 minutes and 25 seconds into the run, we drop and do 25 push-ups. This continues all the way down to an 8 minute and 10 second per mile pace for the last mile. Every time we drop to do the push-ups, blood rushes to my head and I get slightly faint. I'm breathing so hard when we do the push-ups, plus it's friggin' brick cold outside, that I'm slightly hyperventilating. Seal is knocking out the push-ups like a programmed robot. Up, down, up, down, up, down. I'm at around 9 by the time he's done with his 25 and already standing to start running again. Every time. Workout totals, 12 miles, 6 miles escalation pace, 300 push-ups, and 100 burpees. Day 7. Mix up your runs. If it doesn't suck, we don't do it. Seal. New York City to Atlanta, 36 degrees to 75 degrees, 0530. Your runs are too predictable, Thiel says as he stares at me stone-faced.
Predictable?
Yeah, motherfucker, predictable. It's like your legs know what's coming next. It's making shit too comfy. Your body's used to your bullshit jogging routine. Gear up and meet me in 5. We're doing intervals. I throw on my gear and grab a brand new pair of New Balance running shoes. I've been wearing New Balance for 20 years. They're the only things I run in. Once the bottoms get fairly worn out, but not all the way worn out, I replace them with a new pair. I read that having the proper cushion on your sneakers minimizes the impact on your legs when running and therefore reduces the chance of injury. I don't know if that is true or if that was created by a sneaker company, but I bought it hook, line, and sneaker. Regardless, New Balance are part of my routine. 5 minutes later, we're on our way to Central Park for a 7-mile run. We do the first mile at a 10-minute-per-mile pace to warm up. Then every quarter mile after that, we run as fast as we can. After sprinting a quarter mile, we slow down to a 10-minute-per-mile pace again. Seal pushes me so hard on the quarter miles, I can feel my pulse pounding in my neck. I can literally take my pulse by just counting the thumps exploding through my neck. At the end of the run, I'm gasping for air. But it's not my heart or lungs I'm worried about. Man, my legs are really messed up. It feels like a knife is in my calf, I complain. Like I can cramp any second. I grab my leg and walk stiff-legged, keeping my legs totally straight like Herman Munster from the Munsters. Perfect, Seal says. There's only one rule in training. If it doesn't suck, we don't do it. I probably should have broken in my new sneakers because I feel a blister forming on my right big toe. It hurts, but that pain is trumped by the pain in my calf. The blister is more like the middle child at the dinner table. It's not even part of the conversation. It's like I don't even pay it any mind, but I know it's there. It's like Seal has made blisters that previously would have been big deals almost seem insignificant. As a reward for my pain, I get to do 275 push-ups when we get home. To make matters worse, Seal tells me we're going to do them wet.
Wet?
Wet. What does wet mean in push-up land? He tells me that we don't change out of our wet, sweaty-ass clothing. We do the push-ups wet. Why are we doing wet push-ups? Because that's the way I ordered them up today. That's why. I don't give a fuck how you give them to me, but I want all 275. This guy's out of his mind. I drop down and do my first set of 10. My body heat is dropping fast as I cool off from the run. I'm starting to get very cold, like shivering cold. Every time my shirt touches my skin, it feels like a wet ice pack. I look at Seal and he's warm, lukewarm. He's just going down, up, down, up, down, up, 50, down, up, 60. Who is this motherfucker and where'd he come from? I don't know much about Seal's childhood, but I do know that he always wanted to be in the special forces. The other day, while we were sitting around, he mentioned that he